I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. And I apologize in advance if you can hear the storm of the century happening behind me, because we are getting pelted right now, and I'm also a little sick. I've been sick for a few days, but you know, as we say here at Residue, because there ain't no rest for the wicked, I'll be giving you this episode no matter what, so just bear with me. If you can hear all of these distractions, you guys, this is our last episode of 2025. We did it. This is 2 years straight of episode. We started on November 20th, 2023, and here we are today, episode 111. Today, we will be talking about Susan Wright, the blue-eyed butcher. And as you know, here at Residue, we talk about the truth behind your favorite films, and you know that I love a good made-for-TV movie, a good Lifetime movie. So get ready to hear the truth behind the blue-eyed butcher. Before we get started, you can find me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, Facebook at Residue, a true crime podcast, TikTok, where I have the most fun with all of you, at Residue, a true crime podcast. And don't forget, the best thing that you could possibly do for any podcaster, any indie podcaster that you love, is leave a 5-star review. I mean, reviews are fun for everybody, even if they're not indie, but I like to call myself the garage rock band of podcasting, because you know, here at Residue, it is a one-woman show. I do everything, and it feels fucking amazing when you guys leave a 5-star review and let me know what you're loving about Residue. Okay, Residutes, let's do this. Our last show of the year. Happy New Year. Getting to be here with you this past few years has been absolutely just mind-blowing and amazing, and I would not have been able to do any of this if it wasn't for the support of all of you. And don't get me crying before I even start the episode. I love you all, my Residutes. Thank you. Blue-Eyed Butcher is a 2012 true crime drama thriller made-for-television film that originally premiered on Lifetime, and it is based on the real-life case of Susan Wright, who was convicted of murdering her husband, Jeff Wright, in Texas in 2003. Blue-Eyed Butcher is written by Michael J. Murray, and it also credits Jamie Pacino. It's directed by Stephen Kay, and this movie follows the real-life unsettling story of Susan Wright, who is played by Sarah Paxton. And she's just this seemingly ideal wife and mother, the perfect wife and mother, whose life unravels when her husband, Jeff Wright, who is played by Justin Bruning, is found brutally murdered and buried in their home's backyard. Now, in this movie, Susan appears to have this fairy tale life. They portray her as meeting Jeff in this really meet-cute type of way on the beach, and then from the outside, the two look like the perfect couple. And Lisa Edelstein as Kelly Siegler, amazing. I was scared of her. I wouldn't want her cross-examining me. Wait, I mean, I think honestly, if she was cross-examining me, I mean, Kelly or Lisa, I would be like, oh my god, damn girl, you are good at this. I would have to like... stop in the middle of my trial just to give her some, like, hey girl, you're a badass. So in this movie, the story alternates between flashbacks of the Wrights' marriage and the courtroom drama. This is while Susan's lawyer mounts a defense at the same time as prosecutor Kelly Siegler portrays her as this calculating murderer who used her charm to try to escape justice. Because that's what everyone says when they meet Susan, how beautiful she is, how pretty she is. I mean, she is the blue-eyed butcher. Here is a review from Letterboxd, and this is by a user named Todd. This is a 4.5-star review. They loved the movie. It's a Lifetime movie with a hint of Gone Girl, but directed by Tarantino, and I was fucking riveted. When this guy missed a potluck dinner with friends, I knew he needed to be murdered. God, I love Lifetime movies in all capital letters. Blue-Eyed Butcher is a film for people that know that every once in a while, a person can just be pushed too far. Todd goes on to say, you either like Lifetime movies or you don't. They're all melodramatic thrillers with cheese galore, but with this surreal quality that is the sincerity with which the films seem to be made. Appearances have a way of lying, and behind the front door of the Wright home, the story was far more complicated than anyone could imagine. Susan's marriage to Jeff Wright was not the fairy tale it appeared to be, and as the years passed, cracks formed beneath the surface. They were hidden from friends, family, and anyone who wasn't there when the doors were shut and the lights went out. Susan Lucille Wright was born April 24th, 1976, and grew up in Texas. And compared to the notoriety she would later face as an adult, very little about her childhood stood out publicly. Friends and family described her as quiet, polite, reserved, and someone who did not seek attention and generally followed rules. In February of 2010, Skip Hollandsworth wrote an article for Texas Monthly titled 193, and I will be referencing this article quite often during this episode as it was my main source. Skip Hollandsworth actually visited Susan Wright in prison and conducted this interview. So in the film, Blue-Eyed Butcher, you will hear many references to how beautiful, how pretty Susan is, how she really, you know, took care of herself. So I found it so interesting that Skip Hollandsworth mentions what Susan looked like when she came into the interview, because I always wonder what these high-profile inmates who really were on the front pages of newspapers because of their looks a lot of the time, how they would be able to get ready for an in-prison interview. I mean, we all saw that Lori Vallow interview. So he describes her as walking into the room. She was sort of shy, kind of put her head down a little bit. She was very sweet and soft when she said hello, and she was wearing this dark red CoverGirl lipstick. And he said that she kept this in a box in her cell, and this was just for special occasions. He also noted that she smelled wonderful and that she told him she had some perfume because she was able to receive magazines, and she received these fashion magazines in the mail. So she would take the perfume samples and save them, and she would rub them on her neck and in her hair and all over herself whenever she had a guest or a visitor. Susan's older sister, Cindy, said that Susan had a lot of trouble standing up for herself, and there was an example of when she tried out for the drill team, some of the other girls that were trying out were making fun of her, and Susan just cried. She didn't fight back. She just stood there and cried. She felt so defeated from this that she asked her parents if she could transfer to another school. So that's just an example of Susan's personality. Susan was raised in an upper middle class home with her sister Cindy and her brother Jim, and their mother was, and this is in Cindy's words, Susan's sister, the quintessential stay-at-home mom who baked meals from scratch. And their father was a mechanical engineer. And she also states that her father had quite the temper. So Susan and her sister Cindy have gone on to say that their father would beat his mom, berate his mom, just go into these rages right in front of the kids. And then sometimes he would take his anger out on the children. And Susan tells Skip Hollandsworth that we did our best to put a smile on and make everything look normal. When he got mad, we tried not to be seen. And I thought that's what happened in every house. If you had told me every husband didn't yell at his wife or make her feel like less than dirt, I wouldn't have believed you. So Susan thought that this is how it is. This is how life goes. You are the perfect wife, but sometimes your husband's gonna lose his shit. In high school, Susan had this boyfriend. Now, this is her senior year. She just turned 18. She had this boyfriend that told her, you know, maybe you should go work at a topless bar called the Gold Cup. And this was in North Houston. So she did it. And her sister and her mother couldn't believe it. They were just like, oh my God, shy Susan is going to go work at a strip club. Are you kidding me? And Susan thought that if she got this job, if she worked at this club, that maybe all of the attention from the men would make her feel better about herself because she wasn't feeling very attractive. I mean, that boyfriend of hers told her she wasn't. So this stuck in her head. And she thought, okay, this will help. So she goes to this club, she starts working, she only does it for about 2 months. And then she realizes she does not feel comfortable doing this. And the money is definitely not worth it to her. So she graduates high school, she attends a community college, she works at a hair salon. And in April of 1997, on a trip to Galveston, is when she meets her soon-to-be husband, Jeffrey Wright. So Susan meets Jeffrey at the beach. As I said, it's like a little meet cute. They are on the beach hanging out, her and her friend's husband is there, and they meet Jeffrey. And Jeffrey starts getting along really well with her friend's husband. So they all start hanging out. They're driving around that night in one of their cars, and she notices that Jeffrey left his business card on the dashboard. So she took it. And they went on some dates, and she says that Jeffrey was like love bombing her from the beginning. He would buy her flowers, he would take her out to nice bars and restaurants, and he would cook dinner for her. And he told her that he loved her, like pretty quickly. It was only after a couple of dates. And Susan says that Jeffrey was handsome, sweet. He had these big, beautiful brown eyes. And Susan says that he met her parents and told them about his dream of someday owning his own carpeting and flooring business. And Susan just was over the moon. She knew this was it. This is the man that she was supposed to marry. And Jeffrey was in love with Susan also. He told her he loved her, but Jeffrey didn't want to rush things. In February of 1998, they find out that Susan's pregnant. Now, this is less than a year since they met. Jeffrey says to Susan, you know, it would be okay if you got an abortion. But Susan didn't want to do that. And she wanted to get married and she wanted to have this child. So Jeffrey said, okay, let's do it. Let's get married. So she found out she was pregnant February 1998, and then these two marry October 1998 in this really small, quick ceremony. 1 month after being married, their first child, Bradley, was born. And it was no fairy tale after the birth of her first son, because Susan says she was diagnosed with postpartum depression and her doctor wanted to put her on antidepressants, but Jeffrey said hell no. He told her to suck it up and deal with it because this is just what women do. Women have been having babies and being mothers since the beginning of time. What the hell is wrong with you, Susan? He also liked to call her a fat ass. Now, this is all according to Susan. He would do the classic, you gained too much weight when you were pregnant. I want you to lose it all. He would get angry all of the time when she was acting depressed, and he just wanted her to be a stay-at-home mom. And Susan says he literally wanted her to stay at home. He didn't want her to go anywhere. But Jeffrey could go anywhere he wants, and Jeffrey went out a lot. There were times depicted in the made-for-television film where Jeffrey just loved to be at a strip club. I think this is the most times I have seen a strip club in a made-for-TV movie. He would stay out till all hours and never really help out at home. Susan never knew where he was, and she would ask him, "Where have you been all night?" He said she didn't need to know. Susan also claimed that Jeffrey was a drug addict and he was constantly using cocaine. He was constantly drunk. She also said that she had no idea that Jeffrey pleaded guilty in 1996 to a felony drug possession charge and that he was placed on probation. She had no idea that that happened to him. So, this fairy tale marriage seems to be falling apart by 2002. They are married for 4 years. They have two kids now. And people still, on the outside, think that they are the perfect family. I mean, a lot of Susan's friends said that they would get recipes from her. She would tell them little tips on how to clean their home better. So they all just assumed that she loved this role as a wife and mother. But they didn't know that Susan wanted to get out. She wanted to learn. And she signs up for this course that she could take at night. So she tells Jeffrey she could go to campus at night. He could stay with the kids when he gets done with work. And he starts accusing her of cheating on him. And he's calling her a nasty whore because she wants to take a class at the campus. According to Susan, anything would set Jeffrey off. She never knew when he was going to lose it, lose his temper. And she said if she didn't have dinner ready on time, if he didn't like the dinner, if the house wasn't spotless, if the bills were too high, if a customer at work upset him, if he wasn't making enough money, everything seemed to be Susan's fault. And he would kick her. He would punch her. And this is in the chest, in the stomach. He would kick her and punch her in the back of her legs. And she said it was always in places that people weren't going to see the bruises. Now, everyone always asks, why didn't Susan tell anyone? Why didn't she tell her family? And she says it was because she was embarrassed in the beginning. She felt like all of this was her fault, that she made a mistake. It's her fault that her marriage isn't working out because she wasn't the perfect wife. She wasn't the perfect mother. And this was why her husband was beating her, was abusing her. But Susan finally gets the courage to tell her sister what is going on. And her sister is like, no way, we are taking you out of that home. So Susan's sister and her brother-in-law, they show up to the home, they pack everything up in a U-Haul, and they take Susan and the kids to Susan's family's house. But Jeffrey, he finds out. He shows up at Susan's parents' home that very next morning, has his own van, says, get your shit back in this van because you are coming home. And she does. And I know what some people say, and I know that they brought this up a lot in the trial, but they always ask, why didn't you just leave? And at this point, she's already left, and she's home safe with her parents, with her sister. But that question is just so harmful and so wrong, because that question places the blame on the victim instead of the person who's causing all of this harm. Like, why didn't you just leave? Well, why didn't he stop? And leaving an abusive relationship, a marriage, it's not just about walking away. It can involve financial dependence, fear of violence, fear of retaliation, especially from a man like this, children, custody concerns, there's isolation from friends, from family, there's emotional manipulation, there's trauma, and for many people, leaving is the most dangerous time in an abusive relationship, and abusers can escalate threats or violence when they feel like they're losing control. Like Susan says that when Jeffrey arrived at her parents' house, he was like, I'll kill you. Get your shit in the van or I'm going to kill you. So asking why someone didn't leave, this can dismiss the very real fear that they were protecting themselves from in the first place. Abuse is about power and control, and when someone is controlled, manipulated, threatened, their choices are not free. Asking why you didn't leave ignores that imbalance. Susan says by the fall of 2002, Jeffrey's behavior became even more erratic. He started doing things like urinating on his child's bed when he came home drunk from a night out at the strip club. He started buying air rifles. He had weapons in the home now. Susan even claims that on New Year's Day, 2003, he told her, Happy fucking New Year, bitch. That will be your last. And on January 13th, 2003, Susan Wright had finally had enough. Her husband Jeffrey came home drunk that night. He said he was at boxing lessons and he was pretty messed up on cocaine. And now this is all according to Susan. She said that he walked into the home and he started kind of fake boxing with their toddler And he was going, come on, come on, put him up, put him up. And he punched his toddler in the face. Now, it was sort of a jab, but this is a little kid. And their son, Bradley, falls backwards, falls onto the ground, and he starts kind of crying. And he's like, Daddy, I don't want to play anymore. I don't want to do this. And Jeffrey keeps calling him a wimp, a sissy. He's telling him to get back up and be a man. And as I'm saying all of this to you, I just want you to remember that Jeffrey is not here to tell us his side of the story. We are only getting Susan's side of the story, and I am just presenting this to you as I have read about it, as I have watched documentaries about it. Now, we don't know if this is what pushed Susan over the edge that night, her child getting the abuse that she has been receiving, but this is the night that Susan Wright kills her husband, Jeffrey. Numerous friends, co-workers, family members, they all testified for the prosecution during Susan's trial, and they all said the same thing, that Jeffrey was a very happy man, that he was the kind of friend that would do anything for you. He was a great guy, and they would say that he's a very proud father, he's church-going, he's stable, and okay, so we're getting that side of the story, but nobody really knows what goes on behind closed doors. I mean, you could say one of your friends from work is the greatest guy on earth, but when he goes home, we don't know what he does. I remember reading once about narcissistic abusers and how they're not going to treat their friends, their family, the way that they treat the person that they have under control. On the night of January 13th, 2003, after Jeffrey Wright arrived home, tried to box with his toddler, Bradley, punching him in the face and knocking him down, Susan says this is when she snapped. She says that after this incident, Jeffrey was high on cocaine and he told her, let's go in the bedroom. And he ordered her to get into the bed. This is where Susan claims that Jeffrey raped her. And afterward, he left the bedroom and he wasn't gone very long. But when he returned to the bedroom, he had a butcher knife in his hand. He was acting crazy and erratic, waving it over her head and yelling, "Die, bitch." Susan says that this is when she threw her hands up in the air and grabbed the knife away from him and she started kicking him with her knee. He let go of the knife, and now she had the knife, and she said she first stabbed him in the neck, and then she kept stabbing because, in her words, I knew the second that I stopped, he was going to kill me. Susan is stabbing and stabbing and stabbing, and during this entire ordeal, they hear a knock on the door, and it is their child. Their little toddler, Bradley. He hears something. He's like, Mommy, what is going on? She leaves the room. And she leaves Jeffrey in that room to walk her child to his bedroom. Now, she is covered in blood. Susan goes back into the bedroom, but she is convinced that Jeffrey is going to get back up. No matter how many times she stabbed him, he's going to get up and kill her. So she takes these neckties and she ties each arm and each leg to the corners of the bed. And now Jeffrey is completely tied up. And this is why a lot of people don't believe the self-defense defense, because Jeffrey's tied up at this point. And Susan goes into their kitchen and grabs a different knife. And she comes back into the room with a brand new knife. And she says that she just had to make sure that he was dead. So she straddles him and she just keeps stabbing. And in her words, she says, and I was so scared because I didn't want to die. I started stabbing him again. She said that she made sure that she stabbed his penis. And that was for, quote, all of the times that he made me have sex and I didn't want to. Now, they do say in the autopsy report that the stab wound to the penis was a very superficial wound. It was more like a scratch. The rest of his body, 193 stab wounds. 193. Now, I want you just to sit there and try to count to 193. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, It's absolutely insane how many stab wounds there were. She hit his eyes. She hit every part of his body except his back. Now, this is because he was tied up. There were two wounds on his back out of 193. And the defense uses this as, quote, overkill. This was overkill. And she is a battered woman. So this is their defense, that she was so angry from all of these years of abuse that she just lost it. She went crazy. Susan Wright stabbed her husband, Jeffrey Wright, to death on January 13th, 2003, and then she was just delusional. She says that she believed Jeff was still alive. She needed to get rid of his body, but she was afraid that he was going to get up and he was going to still try to come at her. She ends up burying Jeff's body in the backyard in this little gravel dirt pile. It almost looks like it was meant to be a garden at some point. And it's a very shallow hole that she puts Jeff into. And she spends the next few days trying to figure out how to clean up her bedroom so that nobody knows. She's telling everybody she doesn't know where Jeff is. He never came home. And on January 15th, 2003, this is 2 days after, Susan goes into the police department and claims that Jeff is abusive. She decided to file a report on her husband at this point, knowing that he was dead. She tells the police that he always gets mad, he always gets upset. She said that he needed help for substance abuse. And the police are like, okay, this is a victim of domestic abuse. And they immediately issue a warrant for Jeff Wright's arrest, having no idea that he's dead. So police search for Jeff, but friends and family are getting really anxious because they know that something is wrong. They know that this isn't like Jeff. His parents said that their wedding anniversary passed and Jeff never called them. They also say that they drove by the house and Jeff's truck is in the driveway. So where the hell is their son? So 3 days after Susan went to the police department and filed this report on her husband, an attorney named Neil Davis shows up at this same police station and tells them, listen, I have a new client and I need to tell you where you can find Jeffrey Wright's body. Susan and her family hired attorney Neil Davis. Now he shows up to Susan's home to figure out what the hell's going on here, and she shows him where she buried her husband. And he sees her bedroom. Now, he says when you walked into that bedroom that the smell of bleach was everywhere. The carpets were ripped up. The box spring was gone. The mattress was gone. And the walls above the bed had fresh paint on them. Susan's lawyer, Neil Davis, he immediately puts her into a psych ward. While she is there, the prosecutor, Kelly Siegler, needs to question her. She needs a statement from Susan, but she keeps being told over and over, she can't give a statement right now. She's in a psych ward and she'll be out soon, but Kelly Siegler, the prosecutor, she does not want to wait. So on January 23rd, 2003, they charge Susan. She only spent 1 weekend in jail and she made bond over the weekend. So she is now released back to her home. And the thing is that Susan never denied that she stabbed her husband to death because she is going to claim self-defense. Susan Wright's murder trial began on February 24th, 2004, and she had already pleaded not guilty to killing her husband by reason of self-defense. And this is when Assistant District Attorney Kelly Siegler depicts Susan Wright as this manipulative, seductive, scheming wife who seduced her husband into bed, tied him up, stabbed him 193 times, and then buried his body in the backyard. But why? Well, the prosecution says that Susan Wright was hoping to collect a $200,000 life insurance policy on her husband, Jeffrey. Now, Prosecutor Siegler is going to say that Susan did all of this, led her husband into the bedroom to experience some kind of sexual gameplay, and that Susan tied him up and told him, you know, we're going to have some fun tonight. They also found candle wax on Jeffrey's body. So Prosecutor Siegler says this candle wax was there because Susan probably lit a candle, dumped all the candle wax all over her husband's chest, and said, let's have some fun tonight. But when Susan gets on the stand, because yes, Susan does testify in her own defense, Susan says that the candle wax was on her husband's body because after she stabbed him 193 times, she cut the ties off of the bed, but she kept them on his wrist. So this is how she pulled him. And she pulled his body off of the bed. And while pulling it off the bed, one of the candles was lit on the bedside table. His shoulder hit the candle on the table and the wax spilled onto him. And in one of the most unusual moves in courtroom history, Kelly Siegler brings Susan and Jeffrey's actual bed covered in blood, covered in holes from all of the stab wounds, into the courtroom. She places that bed. She has people set it up right in the middle of the courtroom in front of the judge, and she has her assistant get on the bed, the bloody bed. She ties him up and then she straddles him and uses the knife to pretend that she is stabbing this assistant 193 times. Kelly Siegler used one of the actual knives that Susan Wright used to kill her husband. She used the actual blood-stained mattress. And this is just a tiny thing that I just... This part of the case is fascinating to me. But also this, that her co-counsel didn't participate in this courtroom reenactment because this guy's girlfriend said she didn't want Kelly Siegler straddling him and like writhing all over him in the middle of the courtroom. So she used a different assistant. I'm not gonna lie, I probably would say the same thing. I'd be like, babe, I don't want you like laying on a bloody bed while you're really hot. Boss straddles you. Please don't do that. It took only 5 hours of deliberation, and on March 3rd, 2004, the jury convicted Susan Wright of murder. So prosecutors were hoping for a 55-year sentence, but Susan Wright's attorneys argued for probation for their client, and so the jury sentenced Susan to 25 years in prison. This very prominent Texas attorney named Brian Weiss, he said that just about everyone in Houston believed Susan Wright was a monster. Everyone believed that she was some real-life reincarnation of Sharon Stone from the first reel of Basic Instinct. But there was just one problem. Everyone had gotten it wrong. So this attorney, Brian Weiss, he starts filing a series of appeals for Susan Wright, and he was working pro bono because he felt that she did not receive a fair trial. And his argument was that this whole spectacle with bringing the mattress in, the blood-soaked mattress and all the stabbing was, quote, made for TV nonsense. So the judge that presided over Susan's trial, his name was Judge Jim Wallace, he ordered a new sentence hearing in 2009, saying that this new evidence could prove sudden passion arising from an adequate cause. And this time there were new witnesses, such as a woman named Misty McMichael. Misty claims that she worked at a gentleman's club where she met Jeffrey Wright, and she said that he was a, quote, big-time spender, and they began dating. Now, this was before he met Susan. This was long before. She said they were dating, and soon they were engaged. Now, Missy claims the same things that Susan said. She said that he love-bombed her at first. He was very charming, but he became very abusive. He even threw her down a spiral staircase one night. He especially became abusive when he was drinking. And there was proof of this because Misty did file police reports and Jeffrey was charged, but Misty dropped the charges because she was frightened. She was afraid of Jeffrey because he was so violent. November 20th, 2010, Susan Wright's sentence is reduced by 5 years. So she's now sentenced to 20 years. She was first eligible for parole in February of 2014. She was 38 years old, and her first parole hearing was June 12th, 2014. She was denied. But then again, on July 24th, 2017, she was also denied. But Susan Wright was approved for parole on July 2nd, 2020. So Susan Wright is a free woman as of today. When she was released, Susan was required to adhere to strict parole conditions, and these were going to stay in effect until February 2024. These conditions included she had to attend anger control counseling, she had to maintain a job, she had to remain within Texas state limits, and wear a GPS monitor as part of a super intensive supervision. Susan Wright's two children were adopted by their paternal uncle's family following the murder of Jeffrey Wright. In 2010, Skip Hollandsworth asked Kelly Siegler if she truly believed that Susan Wright stabbed her husband 193 times, and if she truly believed that this was because of a $200,000 life insurance policy, and Kelly Siegler replied, "Oh, I don't think anyone will ever figure out Susan Wright's entire motive or understand the depth of her anger." Let me know what you guys think. Leave me some comments on Spotify. Thank you all for another year of Residue. The best Residue anyone could ever ask for. I love you guys so much. And I hope you have a safe, happy new year. And don't forget, stay safe and stay paranoid. Stay paranoid. I'll see you next year.